The Words We Live By. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the supporting cast of the Bible, the sixth in this series of 15 outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel, two of America's foremost men of letters. Mr. Samuel.
The fascinating thing to me about wandering through the Bible to begin with is the effect of solidity and mass and number, as well as the, so to speak, opaqueness of these individuals who appear suddenly as though we were sitting at one end of a large room, and past the open window at the other end of the room, these figures walk, make a few gestures, say a few words, disappear, and you have the impression that they have a past and a future, and all we got was a glimpse sufficient to provide us with an insight into the fullness of their lives.
Well, that suggests to me a novel by Tolstoy or by Dostoevsky or by Dickens or by Balzac has the same sort of thing happen in it. There are certain principal figures who produce the plot, in whose lives the plot takes place, but there are also an indefinite number of persons who appear, just as you say, from time to time. The hero walks down the street, turns into a house, and there are six people there whom we haven't met before and may never see again. But unless a narrative produces out of its background an indefinite number of persons like that, I believe the narrative does not have solidity, does not have thickness.
Well, what's more about the characters in the Bible is the effect of almost an infinite multitude. Actually, I suppose there aren't more than 200 or 300 that we can identify and speak of as individuals. And yet one has the impression, I have the impression of an entire world. And it makes me think of the phrase, as numberless as the stars in heaven. And you remember the phrase, of course, canst thou count the stars in heaven? Actually, the number of stars visible to the naked eye, you probably know, the number of stars visible to the naked eye in the northern hemisphere is not more than 2,000 or 3,000. And yet they produce the effect of infinity because one has the impression that behind them there are countless stars which seem to be thrusting these to the front. And the effect is all the greater because you don't see an infinite number of stars. You couldn't see an infinite number of stars.
Well,
it's a suggestion.
And of course it's important to remember that there's not an infinite number of stars. If there was an infinite number of stars, the sky would be white. Therefore, I think it's important to remember that although there are many, many persons in the background, some of them to appear only for a few seconds and then disappear, yet they're all individuals. In other words, it isn't a mass. It isn't a milky mass of humanity. There are thousands and hundreds of thousands, but there is a limit to their number, which is proper.
Not only that, the simile of the stars occurred to me because just as there are constellations in the sky, so there are constellations among these figures. I often group numbers of the figures into these constellations. I think of characters whom I call grotesques. I think of figures who constitute comics. And there is much more of the element of humor in its ordinary sense than most people appreciate.
Yes.
Then there are the figures whom I call the frustrated, the ones who didn't fulfill something that might have been latent in them, or perhaps it wasn't, it only looks like that, and I put those into a constellation.
Yes, and there are figures who curiously lack the courage that the heroes have, that the stars of the first magnitude have. The great figures of the Bible have, among other things, great courage and will, whereas there are a number of persons, as I hope we'll have a chance to mention some of them, who appear only for a moment in panic, or who, having their will frustrated, give up.
Well, of course, the best known aren't always the most instructive or the most important. I suppose that among the minor figures, as we call them, nobody is better known than Methuselah. And actually, all that is recorded about him is that he was begotten, and he lived 969 years, and he begat, and he set the record for longevity. He must have been the dream of the insurance companies.
Well, there are thousands of such persons. There is that son of Jonathan, Meribal. Would you pronounce his name that way?
I'd pronounce it Meribal if I thought of it.
It has two A's, and I suppose we should put some kind of stop there. Meribal has only one thing known about him, that he was lame in both feet. Remember, he was the son of Jonathan, whom David, in subsequent years after Jonathan's death, wanted to favor because he had loved Jonathan. And so he has Meribal brought into his house, where he has all of his meals with him. And the only thing we learn about him is that he was lame in both feet.
And there are some people that we have an impression about that we know a good deal concerning them. For instance, the Queen of Sheba. She's a very familiar figure to everybody. And
by the way, now, wouldn't she be a case of of an individual, presumably powerful because she's a queen, and yet once presented with the evidence of Solomon's greatness and riches and wisdom, she loses her spirit. She gives up. She collapses and goes back a broken and defeated woman.
It's a rather unfortunate thing that the Bible itself doesn't give us the content of the riddles which she asked Solomon. And there are many commentators have provided us with a lot of riddles, and I must confess that they weren't particularly instructive or brilliant or edifying. We haven't been able to catch up with her riddles or with Solomon's wisdom. By the way, talking about Solomon's wisdom, I must read to you something that I just recently came across, a speech delivered by a man, famous Soviet writer called Ilya Ehrenburg, speaking before the Peace Congress in April 1949. This is what Ilya Ehrenburg said. An ancient legend relates that two women had come before a very wise judge. They were disputing over the possession of an infant. The woman who wanted to pass herself off as the mother answered the judge, "Cut the child in two. She spoke thus because the child was not hers." End quote. How'd you like that?
You mean to say, well, the thing that strikes you is that Ehrenburg merely says an ancient legend, as if he didn't know that this was in...
Well, of course, I presume he knew. It's incredible that he didn't know. This is what you call historic suppression. You mustn't mention the Bible, as you mustn't mention Trotsky, although for very different reasons. It reminds me of the incident in Germany during the reign of the Nazis. There was a poem which had become part of the folklore of Germany, Heine's famous Ich weiß nicht, was soll es bedeuten, the poem about the Lorelei, which they always used to sing when they went down the Rhine and they passed the rock of the Lorelei. It had become such a habit among Germans that they continued even during the Nazi regime because they couldn't stop themselves. So the Nazis had to print that poem of Heine's, but at the bottom they put Unbekannt. Anonymous, author unknown. And this, but the important thing about this citation here, this quotation from Ehrenburg, is it's amazing how the Bible still penetrates, even though they attempt to repress it, and it has become part of the folklore of the Western world, and the characters in it are actually neglected as far as the source is concerned.
Or even their names.
Or their names.
However, Maurice, isn't it still a more serious thing that many of these persons have ceased to be even characters in folklore? I'm told, and I think it's my experience, that fewer and fewer persons recognize references that are made to persons in the Bible, or persons in Shakespeare, or persons in even old American history. You can't count as easily as you once could count upon an indefinite number of people catching a reference and saying, yes, yes, I know what that means, and I know how it's now being applied.
That's true on one side, and on the other hand, the reference has become part of the language detached from its source.
Yes.
Why is it that people are scared of reading the Bible? They have the excuse, and it's a phony excuse, that Shakespeare is difficult to read. He's not. As you've proved.
Of course not.
And as you know. Why? What keeps them from reading the Bible It isn't that the Bible is uninteresting. It's jammed with fascinating material about human beings. I think we're going to cover a number of these persons that appear in the background, and many of those that I have in mind are presented with such a brilliant psychological incisiveness that they make far better reading than the vast majority of what we now accept as popular novels and popular descriptions.
Well, there are certain persons of whom you know only one thing, sometimes more interesting than the fact that he was lame in both feet. There's Naboth, who had his vineyard, which he refused to give to King Ahab, you remember?
Yes.
The only reason that he gives for refusing to give or sell that vineyard is that it was had been given him as a bequest. It had come down from his ancestors. All we know about him is that he sticks to that point. He's faithful to an inheritance.
Well, that brings up, to illustrate the point I made before, phrases that are stuck in the popular mind and the neglect of the source, which is much more interesting than the phrase, a painted Jezebel. Now, Jezebel was the wife of the Phoenician wife of Ahab, and she was the one that needled him into the frame-up against Naboth. We talk about the painted Jezebel. Everybody knows the phrase. But why do they use it without reference to its origin? Actually, this phrase, the painted Jezebel, misrepresents the woman. It wasn't that she painted and that she was a sexually perverted figure. The real wickedness of the woman, which constitutes her dreadful fascination, was quite of another character. She was, in a sense, the Lady Macbeth of the Old Testament, the one who goaded her husband into evil, not because his appetite had been frustrated, not because of the importance of the garden, but she said to him, "Are you the king here, or aren't you the king here? Are you a man or a mouse?" And the wickedness of the woman didn't lie in her painting, it lay in her, in the viciousness of her character.
Yes, as it happens quite incidentally that we hear that on a certain occasion she painted her lips and looked out of her window, but there's no suggestion, as I take it, in the text, that there's anything reprehensible.
No, and she did it only once. That was when she was waiting at the window for the messengers to come, and the day of her downfall. She did that only once. And nevertheless, what's so important, she slew the prophets of the living God. She wanted the death of Elijah. She arranged for the death of Naboth. And all that the popular mind retains is a painted Jezebel.
Yes, and the truly reprehensible thing that she did, it seems to me, is to plot the death of Naboth, merely that Ahab might have his vineyard.
Well, it wasn't, of course, the vineyard. There was this wickedness in her, this profound, this abysmal viciousness that she wasn't going to let anybody stand in the way of her ambitional enjoyment, her husband's.
There are all sorts of persons who appear and flicker and disappear, like poor Uzzah, or Uta. You remember, who touched the ark, who quite inadvertently, I believe, touched the ark upon one occasion and was struck dead. Now, that's all we ever know about him. The poor man had a career before that, and he was missed undoubtedly by a number of persons, but all we hear about him is that he touched the ark.
Well, I suppose he was put in as an illustration that even if you don't know certain laws, the transgression of these laws brings a punishment.
Yes, you may not know that there's such a law as gravity, but if you step off of a building, you fall. And so he fell.
I'll tell you two characters that have interested me very much, and about which little is known, either in the Bible itself or else in the Midrashim around the Bible, are Puah and Shifra. Those were the two nurses among the Jews whom Pharaoh tried to get to kill the infant children,
the
infant males, the midwives of Egypt, and who somehow fooled him. I want to talk about those later. But I was just wondering how many of the listeners recognize these two names, Puah and Shifra, who, by the way, to me are also comical figures, not in an offensive sense, but comical in the sense of almost of a comical strip of plain persons getting the better of some villainous power that's trying to guide their lives.
The sister-in-law of Ruth is a very interesting person to me, Orpah.
Orpah, yes.
Who is accompanying Naomi, you remember, with Ruth. And suddenly, you remember Naomi stops and says to her two daughters-in-law, now go back, because there is no future for you with me. I am going to be an outcast. I shall have no life of my own, and I think you'd better return. Ruth, as we all know, does not make that great speech of hers in which she says that she never will return, never will leave Naomi. Orpah is not distinguished against there. We are not led, I think, to suppose that that she is to be despised by any means. Nothing is said about her motive. As a matter of fact, in a way, it's a good motive. She obeys Naomi. But you can't help following her in your imagination and wondering what happened when she got back and whether she ever regretted this.
She's one of those persons that I refer to as those that didn't fulfill themselves. And they've been the subject of speculation among Jews for thousands of years, and there was always apparently the question in everybody's mind, I wonder what became of Orpah. It's one of those human questions. What did happen to her after she left and she went back? And the legends have woven a very fearsome story around her. She was actually, they say, the sister of Ruth, as well as a sister-in-law. Two sisters married two brothers. And both were the daughters of Eglon, king of Moab. You remember him, don't you?
Oh, yes.
The fat man.
The fat king who was killed by Ehud.
That's right, and he's so fat that when Ehud sticks the dagger into him, the fat closes over it.
Yeah.
Anyway, Orpah went back. And by the way, that word Orpah, the name Orpah, is connected with the Hebrew word Oreth, which means the neck, the back of the neck. They talk about Am Keshe Oreth, the people of the stiff neck, the stiff-necked people, the Jews. She turned her back.
Mm-hmm.
On a possible great destiny. She went back, and the legends tell us what became of her. They link her up with Ruth, after all, because out of Orpah there came, she had many disastrous love affairs, and two giants were born of her. One of them was Goliath.
Hmm.
And out of Ruth, of course, there came David.
Yes.
And there was the famous fight between David and Goliath. The legends are always anxious to follow up these people who walk past the window, and to find out or to surmise where they came from, what they went into.
But all sorts of ironies develop also, Maurice. Now, you remember Lot, when Abraham says to him, we cannot both live in the same country, we must divide our countries in which we're going to live. Lot takes the first choice, makes the first choice, and he makes the best choice, presumably, the rich cities of the valley of the Jordan. He looks out and sees all those cities and all that rich land there before him, and he says, I take that. And Abraham, without question, takes the ruggeder country to the west. I take it that it was ruggeder, the land of Canaan. Now you might say that Lot, therefore, at that point, looked forward to a great future. But the contrary turns out to be the case.
Well, I have a good deal to say about Lot afterwards.
Yes, I should like to talk about him later.
He's a much more complicated character. And the question of why he left Abraham and why, having four daughters, he went to live among the cities of the plain, which in those days had a frightful reputation for wickedness and corruption, why he went to live over there is something that exercises my imagination. We'll come back to him.
Well, yes, but those cities of the plain, the famous Sodom and Gomorrah, were only two of many cities there. It was a rich country, wasn't it?
Oh, but he went to live in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Not, yes,
that's
where he actually
went. Places, and he became a well-known figure there. He is one of those frustrated persons who might have had a destiny and didn't. But speaking almost at random of the way these small figures clustering around the big ones also have lives of their own and yet are in some manner reflections of these greater figures. The most enigmatic figure to me is David, and one of the signs of the mysteriousness, the power of his personality, lies in this odd fact that his name is coupled with others in a series. If I say David to you, what name does it suggest next?
Well, of
David
course.
And?
Jonathan, for one thing.
And?
Bathsheba.
And?
Abigail.
And?
Saul.
And?
Well,
David and Goliath.
And Goliath.
And Goliath.
There's always a...
It's a David and. It's curious how the intensity of the electric field around him, so to speak, fastens personalities onto him in a way that no other Tanakh figure seems to have been able to do. It is evidence of a very powerful and multifaceted personality, which reflects itself in these relationships.
Well, by the way, this tends to be true, Maurice, of all the major figures, does it not? I mean, if I say Abraham, what other names
well,
do you think
of? Well, of course, sir. But you don't think of Abraham and Sarah, or Abraham and Lot.
And Isaac?
Or Abraham and Isaac.
No,
Abraham and Isaac, perhaps, yes. But not in the same curious antiphonal way, like a sort of natural echo.
Well, what if I say Jacob?
Jacob and Esau.
Yes.
Yeah, but how many such associations have you with Jacob?
No, not so many. Well, however, Jacob and Laban, Jacob and...
Oh, now, wait a minute. You wouldn't say Jacob and Laban have the same intensity as David and Goliath or David and Bathsheba.
No, not the same intensity. I grant that.
That is what makes David, to me, the most enigmatic, the most baffling figure.
Well, he is the richest figure of all, I would think. But these other people have a richness, too, which is only qualified.
Yes, but we mustn't get off into these major figures or we'll never emerge from the maze.
Well, by the way, we're not dismissing them, are we?
No, we'll refer to them occasionally. We have to because they're, so to speak, the part of that immense background belonging to the smaller ones. You take a character like Nabal. I don't think many people who are listening to us will remember who Nabal was.
Well, he was a fool.
He wasn't merely a fool. He's one of my grotesques and one of my comics at the same time.
Well, his wife called him a fool. We don't know whether he was or not.
Well, the word Nabal in Hebrew is connected to the word nevela, which means a carcass. Mm. So, under any interpretation, it wasn't a complimentary reference. She called him a fool, and she said that as the name is, so is the man. And in the little sketch that we have of Nabal, we're given a complete picture of a man who was simultaneously a fool and a churl and a carcass. Or, as we would say in popular English, he was just a dog's body. That's really the equivalent of the word nevela as applied to a human being.
However, I have very little to say for Nabal, but I do have this to ask. Doesn't one have a little sympathy with him when the young men of David come to him and say, listen, we've been giving you protection all the time. All summer we've been in your neighborhood and we haven't taken any of your cattle. We haven't bothered you. We have permitted you to exist. Therefore, will you now pay tribute? There's some reason, it seems to me, they have a little sympathy for Nabal when he says, well, I didn't know you were protecting me. I didn't ask you to protect me. Why should I pay tribute to this young man of whom I've heard very little before? Now, it turns out that that's David, and that finally it's very terrible that he'd never heard of him.
Well, there is more to the story than that, as you remember.
Yes, of course.
What actually happened was that Nabal really accepted his protection. He knew about it. And what is more, he insulted David by saying, who is this fellow? All sorts of rebellious servants are out in the world today, and who knows what they're up to. He knew very well what David was up to, and it was his meanness. Because we read a very comical incident that when Nabal was told by his wife, Abigail, what the situation was and what she had done, namely that she'd sent to him, in spite of everything, 200 bunches of raisins and a number of slaughtered sheep and a number of slaughtered cattle, then it says that Nabal's heart failed in him, ran out like water, and in 10 days he was dead. Now, I don't know whether he died because he got frightened of David or because she gave away all that good stuff to David. He dropped backwards, and in 10 days he was dead.
Again, he's one of those persons who fade out, who can be blighted by the opposition of a greater will.
Well, there's something of the grotesque about him.
Oh, yes.
But attached to David, of course, there are so many figures. There's also Uriah the Hittite that I want to say various things about. And a man who is presented with such a devastating psychological clarity that he stands out in my mind as almost a principal figure. That's Shimei,
the
son of Gera.
The man who cursed David.
The man who cursed David. But I'm going to, when we get round to the more detailed discussion of the figures, I'm going to quote that part about Shimei and the way it makes one's blood run cold at this man gone completely wild and hysterical and cursing his head off. And then, of course, there was a story of what happened to him in the end. Then, of course, around David, there's also the prophet Nathan. There are Abner and Joab.
Yes, and there's one woman who appears and almost instantly disappears, the mother of Sisera. You remember?
Oh, yes.
The enemy king.
Yes, she sits at a window, too.
Yes, there has been a battle. We know what the issue of the battle has been. She doesn't. We hear that she leans out of her window looking for her son, the king, to return in glory. And she is imagining that glory. It's something like that great scene in Aeschylus's The Persians. You remember when the Persian elders stand before their palace, Xerxes' palace, off in the east, waiting for the triumphant return of the Persian armies. We know they've been destroyed.
Yes, there's another figure again. There's the woman of the city of Abel, connected also with the name Sheba, but this time it isn't the kingdom of Sheba, it's a man who rebelled against David. And the story of how Job went to that city, and this woman of Abel persuaded him not to destroy the city because of the rebels, but she would throw out the head of the rebel, namely Sheba.
Yes.
She just appears as one of these strong personalities and disappears as rapidly and gives us the picture of a woman whose wisdom dominates the city, and a very powerful woman.
Are those two men in the window who are looking down over the shoulders of Jezebel? And
she's asking them who's coming.
Yeah,
who's coming along there? Yes.
But they're told to drop her, and so they drop her.
And they drop her. They have no compunction about it.
No.
Well, I'm afraid that we haven't covered all the review, the preview of the figures we're going to talk about. So I think that in the next talk we're going to continue with the preview, and I wonder whether some of our listeners will have jotted down these figures and checked against their knowledge of the Bible and their knowledge of what I might call, in addition to that, the folklore of the West, how many of them they were able to identify. Because I think of the list that I have in front of me, and your list doesn't correspond with mine, I've touched only about one half of them. I don't know how many you've gone over.
I think we've only scratched the surface. We haven't mentioned, for instance, the brother of Abraham, Nahor, about whom we know nothing except that he was the brother of Abraham.
Yes, we know nothing either about the father of Lot, except that his name was Haran and he died young. Well, there are hosts of others, and I think we'll have to leave the part of the review for the next one, and then we'll go into a more detailed discussion of what they mean and how they are grouped, according to my view, into these constellations of significance.
Yes, I look forward to doing this.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the 6th in the 15-week Eternal Light Summer Series. We invite you to join us again next week for another in this series of outstanding literary dialogues of past years featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel. Our program will be the second of 10 entitled The Supporting Cast of the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. An eclipse of the sun is a fascinating but a dangerous sight. On Saturday, July 20th, such an eclipse will cover the entire United States. The National Society for the Prevention of Blindness warns that there is no safe way to look directly into the eclipse. Sunglasses, smoked glass, or photographic film are not adequate protection. Even during the eclipse, the sun emits invisible infrared rays which can penetrate glass and film to cause serious burns on the delicate retina of the eye.
There is no discomfort to warn you of the burning since the retina is not sensitive to pain. However, such a burn can rob you of your sharp central vision. To watch the eclipse safely, make a simple viewer from two pieces of white cardboard. Punch a pinhole in one cardboard and with your back to the sun, hold the cardboard so the sun's rays are focused through the pinhole onto the second cardboard. Never look directly at the sun during an eclipse. Don't risk permanent damage to your eyes. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.